Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Dr. Kit Yarrow. I chair the psychology department of Golden Gate University, where I'm also a professor of psychology and business. And I'm your moderator for this program. Please find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program information and to register for programs. And now it's my great honor to introduce today's distinguished guest. Dr. Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University and author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. I'm a huge fan of Dan's work. In addition to just loving the research that he does, I very much appreciate that he has brought behavioral economics and a love of science into the homes of every American. He's really popularized psychology, behavioral economics, marketing, and now truth and honesty for everyone. So please join me in welcoming Dan Ariely.
So thanks a lot. So we want to talk a little bit about dishonesty. And to get us started to think about this, how many people here have lied at least once since the beginning of 2013? Okay. How about the last month? I'm not going to ask you about the last day or the last hour. But there was this very disturbing experiment in which they took two people and put them in the same room, people who didn't know each other, and said, please introduce yourself to the other person. And after 10 minutes, they put them into separate rooms and said, did you lie in the last 10 minutes? And almost everybody said, of course not. And then they said, well, luckily we taped everything you said. Let's play back to you sentence by sentence. And once they did that, they realized most people admitted to lying between 2 and 3 times in 10 minutes. And when you think about this, we all recognize that we lie quite frequently. Right? How many people here think that the right answer to the question, honey, how do I look in that dress, is always, always the perfect truth? Right? One. This is at least your second lie. Now, at the same time that we all recognize that we're slightly dishonest from time to time, how many people here generally think of yourself as honest, wonderful people? The same people, right? And this is the conflict I want to talk about today, about how can it be that on one hand we recognize that we're dishonest from time to time, on the other hand we hold this view of ourselves as being honest, wonderful people. So we've done lots of lab experiments. We brought people to the lab and tempted them to be dishonest. I've also been talking to all kinds of big cheaters, people who've lied in big ways in all kinds of situations. I want to tell you a little bit about my discussions with big cheaters and a little bit about the lab-based research. So one of the first discussions I had with people who were dishonest in a big way was with a guy called Sam. And when Sam was 12 years old, he was brought to work for his cousin Eddie. And his cousin Eddie had a retail store for electronics, TV, VCRs, radio, stuff like that. And at age of 12, he learned the 3 lessons of retail. Lesson number 1 was that they put ads in the paper for cheap stuff, but then when people come in to buy it, they actually try to upsell them. And they had a particular way of doing it. They would attack them by 3 salespeople, one after the other, all telling them that what they were going to buy is not a good idea, they should buy something else. The second thing they told him was that their money that they were making was their money, and there's no need to confuse the government with that. And of course, there's no need to pay tax, so everything should be off the books in cash as much as possible. And the third rule of retail they told him about was every winter they would take all the merchandise they couldn't sell and they would put it one part of the warehouse. They would pretend the pipes above it broke. they would take a hose, they would wet the merchandise, and they would submit an insurance claim. Sometimes the insurance company would let them keep the merchandise for a small fee, in which case they would switch to a different insurance company and wet the same merchandise again the next year for the next insurance company. Anyway, Sam grows up in this environment from age 12. And then he gets to be 18. He gets to be 18 and he goes to college. And what do you think he goes to study? Accounting. Accounting. Where have you been? The last 6 years have kind of made no impression on you. Okay. So he goes to study accounting, and after about 2 years of accounting school, he comes back to the family. This is a family-run business. He comes back to the family and he says, we have been doing things the wrong way. He says, we have been skimming. We have been taking an amount of money and not paying taxes on this. He said, this is no way to be rich. He said, if you really want to be wealthy, we need to have an IPO. Then we can dump stocks, then we can be really wealthy. So he said, what I want us to do is to become a public company, but for a public company to have a successful IPO, you want to show an increase in revenues. Now, how do you show an increase in revenue? If you're a regular company, you work harder. If you're the Antar family, what can you do? You can cheat less. So they have a plan in which for 4 years, they cheat by one quarter less every year. Until in the last year, they're perfectly honest. And then they have a very successful IPO and they dumped about $100 million worth of stock in the next year. Up to this point of the discussion, Sam seems like the poster boy for the Chicago School of Economics. Like the guy is perfectly rational, right? It's all about money and maximizing. There's no emotion. He's okay to, you know, he doesn't care about customers. He doesn't care about the shareholders. He doesn't care about the government, insurance. He doesn't care about anything. He's just trying to maximize money. But here is where the discussion changed. And I asked him how did the family eventually fail, because eventually most of them spend a lot of time in prison. And he told me the following story. He said the family was a very hierarchical family. Eddie's father was the head of this pyramid, and he would hold court. And people would come to him for advice and suggestions and information. And he loved his position at the head of this hierarchy. His son, Eddie, all of a sudden became incredibly wealthy. And what also happened is people started looking for Eddie for advice. So people started going to Eddie for suggestions and ideas and so on. And his father didn't like his new position. He didn't like being second in command. So he tried to pull things back, but $100 million is too much. He was having a really hard time fighting that. So what did he do? Well, Eddie had a wife called Debbie. And behind her back, everybody called her Debbie One. You see where this is going. He also had a mistress, also called Debbie, and everybody called her Debbie Two. One New Year Eve, Eddie's father called Debbie One and gives her the address for Debbie Two's apartment. And she goes to the apartment, and Sam said that they call this in the family the New Year Massacre. And this is the place in the discussion that Sam is morally disgusted. He's appalled. He looks at me and he says, there are some things you don't do. There are some lines you don't cross. You don't tell a wife about her husband's mistress. Now, everything else was perfectly fine, right? Government, insurance, taxes, no problem. This was a moral violation. And he was not the only one who felt this was a moral violation. The whole family split as a reaction to this. And they basically gave the FBI information about the other fraction of the family. By the way, Sam also said that if that didn't happen, the family would have held together and the chance for the FBI to actually penetrate him would have been very, very low. But the fact is that they gave each other up over this feud, over this moral violation. Now, the story of Sam has a lot of interesting things, right? You can say, what happened to somebody who's at age 12, you put them in that environment. Can they ever develop a moral fiber? But the thing that kind of started me wondering is whether we all have a little bit of Sam in us. So think about it. Was Sam immoral? Was he amoral? No. It's true that he was not moral in many aspects of his life. But he had some aspects of his life in which he was very moral. His word was his word. His handshake was his handshake. What he promised within the family had incredible morality. It's just that everything that had to do with outside of the family had no moral questions about it. And we can ask whether we're all a little bit like this. So for example, how many people here have illegally downloaded material on your computers? Right? I'm guessing everybody below 50 has it, and above 50 you just don't know how to do it. Now imagine that somebody found out that you had illegal download music on your computers. How many people would be ashamed and embarrassed? Almost nobody, right? This is the same as Sam. It's basically saying we've taken an activity in life, illegal download material, and we said this is not really a moral issue. This is just something we do, but we don't feel bad about it, right? This is, by the way, also what corruption is about. Corruption is about something that we know is illegal, but we don't care, right? Okay, so I have lots of other stories about big cheaters, but I want to switch a little bit and talk to you about some of our lab experiments. So when we try to study dishonesty, we want to try and quantify it. So how do we quantify it? We have a few different methods, but I'll describe to you one. In this method, we give people a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems. These are problems that everybody could solve if you have enough time, but we don't give you enough time. So if you're in the experiment, I would pass the sheets of paper around, and I would say you have 5 minutes to solve as many of these questions as you can. I'll give you $1 per question. Ready, set, go. You would turn the sheet of paper and you'd start working as fast as you can. At the end of the 5 minutes, I would say stop, put your pencil down, and count how many questions you got correctly. And now that you know how many questions you got correctly, please take the sheet of the paper, go to the back of the room and shred it. And after you finish shredding it, come to the front of the room and tell me how many questions you got correctly. I'll pay you accordingly. People do this. They come. They say they solve 6 problems. I pay them $6. They go home. What the people in the experiment don't know is that we played with a shredder. The shredder shreds the sides of the page, but the main body of the page remains intact. Talking about dishonesty, right? But this is for science. This is for science. So we can go in and we can find out how many questions people really solve correctly. And what do we find? On average, people solve 4 and report to be solving 6. Now you could say, where is this difference in mean comes from? Is it comes from a few big cheaters that shift the mean? No, it comes from a ton of little cheaters. We ran this experiment so far on more than 40,000 people, different versions of this. And we found about 20 people that were big cheaters. And together they stole maybe $300 from us. And we found about 25,000 little cheaters that stole about $50,000 from us together. And I actually want you to think about this, right? That there's some big cheaters out there from time to time, and it's really sad when it happens. But I think that the economic magnitude of lots of small dishonesty is much, much larger than the few instances of big dishonesty. Okay, so now we have a method to quantify dishonesty. And now we want to understand what drives it. What are the causes for it? The standard economic theory for dishonesty is very simple. Gary Becker, many years ago, proposed that cheating, dishonesty, is just like every other decision. It's all about cost and benefit. You go by a grocery store and you say to yourself, how much money do they have in the till? What's the chance they'll catch me? And if they'll catch me, how much time will I get in prison? Is it worth it or not? That is the economic rational theory that's supposed to drive dishonest behavior. But you can ask yourself, is this the right theory? So first of all, we can look at some macro thing in society. We can look at something like the death penalty. If people do the cost-benefit analysis, What would happen in states that have the death penalty? You'd expect no crime. People would say, oh my goodness, I could get killed for this. Not worth it. Right? And then all crime will stop. All crime that has the death penalty. But of course, there's no evidence for that. In fact, if you look at states that have the death penalty and states that don't have the death penalty, there doesn't seem to be any difference in crime rates. What about California? You had this wonderful thing called three strikes and you're out. Right? Somebody could steal three slices of pizza, one after the other, and go to life in prison. You would say, on the third one, everybody will do the cost-benefit analysis. Nobody would go to prison. Not the case, right? It was just got more people to prison for longer without any decrease in propensity to commit crime. You can also reflect about your own lives. When was the last time you thought about the cost-benefit? Bless you. There must have been some times in which you went to some friend's house for dinner maybe, and you went to wash your hands in the bathroom, and they had these new wonderful towels. And you had your little bag with you, and you could have taken them, and nobody would have found out. Have you thought about this? Maybe now you would start. In the last few years, every time I go to a restaurant, I ask the waiter if there's a way to eat and escape without paying. I said, look, I'm not going to do it. I'm just interested. If you were going to do it, how would you do it? And aside from one time, they always give me good advice. Right? Wait for a big party to come. There's an alley. There's a bathroom. They have ways to do it. And then I say, and how often do people actually do that? I say, almost never. Right? Now, here's an activity, and I'm not encouraging this, but here's an activity that you can commit a crime, and even if you get caught, you could say, I'm sorry, I just forgot to pay. Right? The odds of it ending up badly is very low. And nobody does it. Why? Because you would feel bad. Right? Illegal downloads, nobody feels bad about it. Right? What differentiates those things, illegal downloads and escaping without paying in a restaurant, is not the probability of being caught, is not the amount of punishment, it's how bad we feel about that. So in our experiment, we test the Becker model. We change the probability of being caught. We see no difference. We change the amount of money people stand to gain. We see no difference. So now the question is, how do we think about feeling bad about something? What is that? So we thought that maybe it's all about rationalization. Maybe what's going on is that we want to do two things at the same time. We want to look at the mirror and feel good about ourselves. We want to feel that we're good, honest, wonderful people. We also want to selfishly benefit from dishonesty. Just for now, just a little bit. Now, if we cheat a lot, we might not be able to think of ourselves as good people. But maybe as long as we cheat just a little bit, we can rationalize it away. So the key, perhaps, is to think about what causes us to be able to rationalize dishonesty. And if we can rationalize dishonesty to a higher degree, maybe we'll be more dishonest. And if we can rationalize it to a lower degree, maybe we'll be less dishonest or more honest. So let me ask you, if you were thinking of rationalization as the central mechanism, what would help people rationalize bad behavior? I'm sure you've rationalized before. What helps people rationalize? Other people do it, for example. So here's an experiment on other people do it. We do the same experiment I described to you earlier, but we hire an acting student. And we ask the acting student to sit in the front row. And 30 seconds into the experiment, the acting student raised her hand and said, I solved everything, what do I do now? Now imagine you're in the experiment. You are on problem number one. And that person is saying that they solved everything. And the experiment is saying, you solved everything, you're free to go. And you see that person standing up. And in this version of the experiment, we also prepaid people. We gave them an envelope with all the money. And we asked them to give us back the money they did not make. You see that person standing up, taking their money, leaving nothing behind, and going away. What would happen to your own morality? In this case, lots more people cheat. But it could be two interpretations here. One interpretation is we just prove to people that in this experiment you can cheat and get away with it. Here's the proof. Somebody stands up, they're going away, nobody's chasing them, there are no downside consequences. The other possibility is that by that person doing something, they give you a personal example that this kind of behavior is actually okay in your society. How do we separate these two accounts? The way we did it was we changed the outfit of the acting student. And here's the story. We ran this experiment at a university called Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Everybody in the room was a Carnegie Mellon student. The acting student was a Carnegie Mellon student. He was wearing the Carnegie Mellon outfit. In the second version of the experiment, he was wearing a sweatshirt of the University of Pittsburgh. Now, what happens when a University of Pittsburgh student stands up and cheats and goes away with all the money? You learn in the same way that in this experiment you can cheat and get away with it. Here's the proof. But what you don't learn is that people like you are doing it. In fact, it's these other people we don't like so much. So what happened to cheating in this condition? It goes down. It goes down dramatically. So everybody else is doing it, gets us to cheat more, but only to the extent we think of ourselves as part of that group. Talking about politicians, for example, right? You can think about how when some politicians start misbehaving, it can create a big escalation in misbehavior very quickly. What else would change rationalization? Not hurting anybody. That's a great one. Yeah. What else? Nobody will know. Nobody will find out. So that could be both of them, right? You could say nobody will find out. It could be the cost-benefit analysis. But also you could say it will never be part of the registration. Yeah. The people who are hurting deserve that. That's an interesting one. So we did. Listen. Yeah. So we did an experiment on this. We basically came in a coffee shop to people and we said, hey, would you do a study for 5 minutes for $5? We'll ask you to circle some letters. And people said yes, and we gave them the sheet of paper. 5 minutes later we came, we said, thank you very much. Here's your $5. Please sign a receipt and leave it here and we'll be back to pick it up. But we actually gave them $9. We ran this in Boston. How many Bostonians do you think returned the extra cash? About 50%. In the second version, you can... San Francisco would be much higher, there's no question. In the second version of the experiment, the research assistant annoyed them a little bit. When he explained to them what the task is, how do you circle a letter, he picked up his cell phone as if somebody called him, and he talked to John about pizza for 12 seconds. Hey, John, what's up tonight? Pizza, my place, great. Put the phone down, went back, described everything. And then the same thing. Here's your $5, please sign it, a receipt, and so on. What happened now? Now only 14% of the people gave their money back. Right? In their mind, people probably thought that they were kind of okay. Maybe they're even doing something good. Maybe they're restoring karma to the world. Right? You did something bad to me. We had another experiment on this. We bought a vending machine and we broke it. And the way we broke it in specifically was we said the price was 75 cents for candy, but we set it internally to be zero. So you put the money in and you got the candy and the money back. And we observed how many candies people took. And we put a big sign that says, here's the phone number if something goes wrong. Almost everybody took either two or three candy bars. Nobody took four, right? That's just too much. That's too much. Two or three is okay. And the other thing we noticed is lots of people called their friends to come as well. And I think part of it is that if your friends partake in this, you feel less bad about it. It's kind of more okay. And you know, I think also people probably had a rationalization. They probably said, you know, there was at least two machines that took my money before and didn't give me anything back. It's my turn. There's some kind of vending machine karma. We're just restoring it right now. Okay, so we think about how you get people to rationalize. I'll tell you one more version of this. There's a little joke that Johnny comes home from school with a note from the teacher that said that little Johnny stole a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to him. And Johnny's father is furious. And he said, Johnny, I'm so embarrassed and humiliated. You never, never, never steal a pencil from the kid who's sitting next to you. You're grounded for 2 weeks and just wait until your mother comes. And besides, Johnny, you know very well that if you need a pencil, all you need to do is to say something. You can ask, you can mention it, and I can bring you dozens of pencils from the office. Now, why is this slightly amusing? Because I think we all recognize that if we took 10 cents from a petty cash box, we would think of ourselves as thieves. If we took a pencil, not so much. We can say the office has it here for us to take. Everybody's doing it. Even if I take it and give it to my kids, they'll leave me alone. I'll answer 2 more emails. It'll be good for the workplace. Maybe I'll be more effective at work, at home. So we did these experiments in 2 ways. The first one was we tried it with golf. Anybody here plays golf? A few? Okay. So we did a study on about 12,000 golf players. And we asked them lots of questions. But one type of question was we said, imagine your ball fell on the rough. Not a good place. And you really wished it was 4 inches to the left. Would you pick it up and move it by 4 inches? And people said, heaven forbid. I can't imagine doing that. Just by the fact you're asking this question, it means you don't understand the nature of the game. This is just not what golfers do. Okay, fine. What about kicking it a little bit? Yeah, that's no problem. Hitting it with a club, even easier. It turns out the easiest one is when you're not looking. You look up and then you kick a little bit. That's the easiest one. We did another experiment. Imagine the same experiment with a sheet of paper. But when people finish, in one version they come to the experiment and they say, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X dollars. In the other one they said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X tokens. We paid them a piece of plastic. They take this piece of plastic, walk 12 feet to the side, and change them for money. The difference between those two is when you look somebody in the eye and you lie for something that is not money, but becomes money very quickly. What happened in this experiment? Our participants doubled the amount of their cheating. And this, by the way, was one of the most worrisome experiments for me that we've ever created, because if you think about it, as a society, we're moving away from money. Cash, credit cards, electronic wallets, stocks, derivatives. I mean, you can think about it. Dealing directly with people over a great distance. Could it be that as these distances increase, we would have an easier time behaving unethically but thinking of ourselves as ethical people at the same time? Okay, so we talked about how do we get people to be more dishonest. And we talked about the environment. And actually, by the way, if you think about it, I think this explains lots of what happened in 2008 in the financial crisis. Right? Imagine I made you a banker in Wall Street in 2006, and that every year I would give you a $5 million bonus if you could only see mortgage-backed security as a good product. Would you be able to do it? I'm not saying would you lie, would you say, oh, these are terrible, I'll just tell people they're good. No. Wouldn't you actually believe that they're good? And what if there are multiple steps removed from money and everybody is doing it and difficult to compute and you have a theory to justify it? Now you can see how you create an environment where people have a motivated reason to view mortgage-backed security as a good product and lots of way to rationalize that you'd expect nothing but bad behavior. Okay, so we said, how do we get people to rationalize more? How do we get people to rationalize less? So you can do the opposite from everything we've said before, but what else can you do? How do you get people to rationalize less? So the idea here also came from a little joke, and the joke is that the guy goes to the rabbi. He said, Rabbi, you wouldn't believe what happened, but somebody stole my bicycle from synagogue. And the rabbi is appalled. Stealing your bicycle from synagogue? This is terrible. He said, I'll tell you what you do. Come to synagogue next week and sit in the front row. And as we go over the Ten Commandments, turn around and look at everybody in the eyes. And when we get to thou shalt not steal, see who can look you in the eyes, you'll know that's your thief. The guy is very excited, the rabbi is excited, comes to synagogue, sits in the front row, turns around during the Ten Commandments. At the end of the services, the rabbi can't wait. He waits for him at the door. He said, so did it work? It worked? The guy said, like magic. He said, like a charm. He says, The moment we got to thou shalt not commit adultery. I remembered where I left my bike. You are probably wondering, where's the experiment in this joke? So we went to UCLA, and we asked about 500 undergrads to try and recall the Ten Commandments. By the way, none of them could recall all Ten Commandments. Many of them invented new, interesting ones. There might be some California-specific issues there. But what happened after we asked people to contemplate the Ten Commandments? Nobody cheated. It wasn't as if the people who remembered more commandments, the more religious people, cheated less, and the people who could hardly remember any commandment cheated more. Nobody cheated. In fact, even when we take self-declared atheists and ask them to swear on the Bible, and then we give them a chance to cheat, they stop cheating. So it's not so much about heaven and hell and what you believe, it's about, at the moment, what you get people to consider. We did this experiment, by the way, with a big insurance company. This was an insurance company that sends people a form that says, how many miles did you drive last year? And if you get this form, what do you want, to increase the number or decrease it? You want to decrease it, your premium would go lower. So some of the forms, people write the number and then sign at the bottom. This was 10,000 form. The other 10,000 form, we got people to sign first. I declared everything I'm saying is truth, and then they filled in. The people who signed first cheated much less. They reported to be driving 2,400 miles more on average. Now, we don't know if they didn't cheat at all, because we didn't check the odometer, but they cheated by 15% less at least, which is very good news. In summary of this initial part, I want to tell you that all of this is about conflicts of interest and rationalization. And I want to tell you one personal story about this. So as you can tell, I was burned a long time ago. I spent a long time in hospital. And maybe 4 years after I left hospital, I came back for a checkup. And the head of the burn department finds me and he said, Dan, I have a new fantastic treatment for you. Come with me to the office. I go with him to his office. And what he's telling me is saying, look, when you shave, he says, you have on the left side of your face, you have stubble, little black dots. The right side of your face is burned. There's no stubble. There's no hair. And this is non-symmetric. So what is he proposing? He is going to tattoo the right side of my face to fit the left side of my face. And he says, go home, shave, come tomorrow, we'll fix you up. I drive home and I think to myself, what kind of shave should I try to optimize for? The morning shave, the afternoon shadow, you know, what would give them more hours of symmetry throughout the day? Anyway, I come back to his office the next day and I said, you know, I'm not so sure I want this. Have you done this to other people? He said, yes, I've done it to two other people. I said, can I see pictures? He said that he couldn't show me the whole face for privacy reasons, but he showed me just pictures of their cheeks, and sure enough, they were cheeks with little black dots, much as he promised. And then I said, what happens when I grow older and my hair becomes white? He said, don't worry, we can laser it out when the time comes. And I said, you know what, I'm not sure it's for me. I'm just not sure it's for me. And then he looks at me and he says, Dan, what's wrong with you? Do you enjoy looking non-symmetrical? Do you get some deprived pleasure from looking different? Anyway, I was kind of shocked about this. So I went to his deputy and I said, what's going on? And he said, you know, they've done it to two patients already. They need a third one for an academic paper. And I was an ideal patient, right? Half the face burned, half not. It's a really good patient for this paper. Now, here is the thing. This physician was an amazing physician. He died 10 years ago, very sadly. But he was an amazing physician. You see the right half of my right eyebrow? It was, you know, one of the things that got burned off. And he wanted to create a new half an eyebrow for me. And I couldn't care less. And he wanted to operate. I said, no. But at some point I had a really big operation on my hand. And I said, you know what? If you could do it at the same time, fine. So he went into the operating room with the other team. But he couldn't do it because they were taking too much space. So the hand operation took about 9 hours. He waited until they finished. He started working at 9 in the evening and worked most of the night. This looks like a half an eyebrow, but he took a Doppler machine. He tracked the blood vessel, isolated a piece of hair, tracked the blood vessel back, redirected it. The guy worked the whole night giving me half an eyebrow. He really cared, right? And he cared. He was my physician for 3 years. I can't think of him in anything but the most wonderful, caring terms. Nevertheless, at that moment, he wanted that paper out. Right? And at that moment, his conflicts of interest was a little too strong to get him to behave in the right way. So, and you know, and we have conflicts of interest everywhere, right? You can think about your own service providers. You can think about yourself. You can think about lobbying. You can think about all kinds of things. I want to make two more points. The first one is to say something about cultural differences. And the second one is to say something about dishonesty over time. So we've done all kinds of experiments. Everything I've described to you up to now was one shot. We gave people one chance to be dishonest. What happens when we give people hundreds of chances to be dishonest over time? One of the patterns we see is that people cheat a little bit, balancing, being good, cheating a little bit. And then at some point, many people switch and start cheating all the time. Now, the point in which they switch is different, but at some point they switch. And we call these points the what the hell effect. And you can think about it, right? If you think to yourself, honest, not honest, I'm dishonest, I might as well enjoy it. And many people recognize this from dieting, right? You start a diet and then you have something and you say, you know what? I'm not a dieter. Maybe next Monday, today, I'm going to go all the way. And it's because we think of ourselves in binary terms. We're either good or bad. We're either honest or not honest. If you're 78% honest, should you invest in getting to 83%? Right? Not worth it. Now, you could be 92% honest and think of yourself as honest, but at some point you say, really, what's the point? Let's go and at least enjoy it. So we thought, if people have this pattern, why would they ever stop? So we thought about the Catholic confession. Anybody here Catholic? A few. Anybody grew up Catholic? A few more. So we thought about the Catholic confession. This is no offense to the Catholics in the room, but we went to talk to real Catholics. We went to Italy. We went to talk to Italian priests and we said, look, explain to us the logic of confession. From an economic rational perspective, if you can sin and get absolved, wouldn't you sin more? In fact, wouldn't you sin on the way to confession to minimize time in purgatory? And the priest said no. So we came up with a few theories. One theory is the forward-looking theory. Saying, you know what, I'll steal this something from this grocery store, they might catch me, they might not, but for sure I'll have to talk to the priest. And this will be unpleasant and not fun and not going to enjoy it, not worth it. No evidence for that theory. Another possibility is like the Ten Commandment experiment. You finished coming from confession and you feel pure and wonderful and so on, and you want to keep that feeling. And indeed we find some evidence for this. Also families report they don't fight on the way back from church. It's a good thing. But we were most interested in this what the hell effect. So we got people to the lab, they cheat a little bit, they start cheating a lot. And then we gave them a chance for a non-Catholic confession. Here's a piece of paper, if you want, why don't you write something that you've done badly recently and shred it, we don't want to see it. And then here's another piece of paper, why don't you ask forgiveness from whatever deity you believe in and shred it as well. What happened after you do both of those? Say what you've done wrong and ask for forgiveness. Cheating goes down to the pre-what the hell effect. Now, if you give people a lot of time, it goes up again. But at least for a while, it operates. And for me, this is very interesting because it suggests something that religion has figured out. That religion has figured out the importance of opening new pages. And I think it's an interesting question of how do we do it in civic society? What would be a civic celebration and starting of having a new beginning and starting fresh? Otherwise, why would you behave well? And one example, of course, is the Reconciliation Act in South Africa. When you say, how does a country move from an apartheid era to a post-apartheid era? There's no smooth transition. So the Truth and Reconciliation Act, basically people stood up on stage and said, here are all the awful things we've done, and we're going to try and do things differently from now on. And it doesn't erase apartheid, but at least it creates a demarcation. And I got an email not too long ago from a woman in Greece. And she said that now they want her to pay taxes. She's about to sell her. I said, why now? Can't they start in 2 weeks from now? I'm just selling my house now. Can't they start next year? The problem is that there's never a good time to start being honest. Today is not a good day, but if you have some demarcation, it's incredibly useful. And finally, I want to say something about cultural differences. How many people here grew up outside of the U.S.? Raise your hand. And keep your hands up. Keep your hands up. And how many people here think that in your country of origin, people cheat less than Americans? Less than Americans. Keep your hands up. Canadian? Yeah. There was somebody there? No. Okay. So, oh, where are you from? Canada as well? Yeah. So we also wanted to try this. So we went to different countries. I grew up in Israel, so the first country I went to test was Israel. How many people here think that in Israel, people would cheat more than in the U.S.? This is a relatively politically correct group, I'm guessing. I was sure that people in Israel would cheat more, but no, it was just the same. We tried Turkey, we tried China, we tried Germany, England, we tried Canada, they're just the same. Colombia, South America, every place we've been, we haven't been everywhere, but every place we've been so far, we haven't found differences. South Africa, I just came back from Kenya, the same results. Now, here's the strange thing, right? On one hand, everybody who's traveled have seen dramatic differences in dishonesty in other places. We have the corruption index that tells you something about corruption in different countries and how much it varies. How can it be that in our experiments we don't see any differences? And the reason is that our experiments are basic and abstract, and they're not embedded in any culture. And because of that, they taste the basic human ability to cheat and feel okay about ourselves, to rationalize. And we are all the same. Now, that doesn't mean that culture doesn't matter. Culture does matter, but it operates on top of it. Culture can take a particular activity, illegal downloads, and say, don't worry about it. Bribing a policeman, don't worry about it. Or in the case of Sam that we started with, everything in life outside of the family and don't worry about it. So culture does matter, but culture doesn't change the basic human fiber. Culture just changes the rules we use to apply in particular domain. However, we did find one difference. When we do these experiments, we either go to universities and test students, or we go to bars. And we go to universities because we think students are the same everywhere, and we go to bars because we think people who go to bars are the same everywhere. And when we go to bars, we also change the payment. We adjust the payment so that every four questions people answer correctly, they get the equivalent of one glass of beer in that establishment. So beer becomes our international currency. So one experiment, we went to Washington, D.C., and we went to a bar where congressional staffers hang out in. And then we went to a bar in New York City. This was a bar where bankers hang out in. And this was the only place we found a difference. So who do you think cheated more, the bankers or the politicians? Who votes for bankers? Raise your hand. Who votes for politicians? Look, you have to vote. This is not like a political. You have to vote here. You have to commit. Who votes for bankers? For politicians? Okay, so the vast of you think it's the politician. It was the bankers, 2-1. You can't be happy about this. This is not a result to be happy about. No, this is sad. But I should point two things. One is that the bankers cheated more, but this was cheating in money, which might be the domain of bankers, more domain of politicians. And the second thing was these were congressional staffers. These were just junior politicians with tremendous room for growth. I don't know what the time is, but let me just finish with one little joke. I told you a little bit about Judaism and Catholicism. A guy goes to confession and he says, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned." And the father said, "What have you done, my son?" And the guy said, "I'm 70 years old and I just had sex with two 25-year-old twins." And the priest is beside himself. He said, this is just awful. I want you to say 1,000 times Hail Mary and walk around the church 100 times, and I want you to give $50 and $100 to charity. And how long has it been since your last confession? I've never been to confession. What? You're 70 years old and you've never been to confession? How can that be? I'm Jewish. So if you're Jewish, what are you doing here and why are you telling me? I'm telling everybody.
Dan, thank you very much. Our big thank you to Dan Ariely, professor at Duke and author of the new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. It's time for Q&A. We've got a ton of questions, so let's get started. Dan, everybody wants to know, are you more of a liar or less of a liar than others? And how did you get interested in this topic? I think they're wondering if there's some projection going on here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I'm, before I started doing this research, I was more or less than other people. But I'm very, very careful now.
What was your last lie?
Well, I had this, not really lie, where's George? So George called me at 15 minutes before I was stuck in traffic. He said, when are you coming? And I said, is it today? here is a lie I told last week. One of my friends was going into surgery, and he was going to have a very delicate surgery in his hand. And as somebody who went through lots of surgery, he asked me how much pain I think he will have. And I lied to him. I told him I don't think it will be that bad. And this, I think, is the question of, you know, should I have created 10 days of anticipated agony, or should I have tried to reduce that? And I think many times, you know, sometimes we lie for selfish purposes, but many times the lies are altruistic, right? We're doing something for the benefit of others. The places that I'm particularly careful about are places with conflicts of interest. So, you know, the amount, I'll give you, the opportunities for people to get paid to express some opinions are very, very substantial. And kind of in my field, there's a lot of those. And I worry very much about this. So I try to avoid that. In terms of interest, my interest in this actually started from Enron. And the thing that I wondered about when Enron happened was whether this was an outcome of three bad apples or whether this was something much more systemic. And the reason this is important is that if you think that Enron and things like that are an outcome of a few bad apples, you said, let's just improve HR practices. Let's just make sure we don't hire these people. But if you think that wishful blindness is very general and can happen to everybody, then you want to think very differently about the structure of institutions and what kind of institution you want to create. So this work actually started a long time ago, and then when the financial crisis came, it became apparent to me how relevant this was. And, you know, do you think bankers are evil? No, I mean, there probably must be some, but in general, they're good people. But they're good people who also have conflicts of interest. The same thing goes for physicians, for everything else. And I think we're creating these systems with terrible conflicts of interest, not realizing what we're doing. So my hope is that by understanding this research, that the legislature would do better systems and we would be individuals would learn to protect ourselves.
That makes sense. Let's make a quick announcement here that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Dr. Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. He's discussing his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Okay, now I got three questions from the audience wanting diet advice.
Very good.
And somebody also wondered whether Fitbit or the Nike, were those helpful?
So dieting advice.
Yeah.
So I think the real issue is rules. is strict rules. There's lots of ways to think about dieting, but from the perspective of dishonesty, the real issue is to what extent will you be able to fool yourself? So, you know, the practice of having a cake and just kind of straightening it out every time? That's a recipe for bad things. And in fact, with dieting, it's very tough, right? If you're a smoker, you know if you smoke or don't smoke. It's a binary thing. If you're a dieter, there's no one line. It's like it's always one more spoon, one more fork, a little bit more. And those are the places where we fail very frequently, and we convince ourselves that we don't fail. So from this perspective, the question is, can you create some rules that are very fast and straight rules that you don't violate? And if you create those, it will be actually easier to stay on a diet. The Fitbit, I think it can help for multiple reasons. I think one thing is it can create competition. So people can start looking at other people and saying, what am I doing? What are you doing? Where are we? People also love collecting points.
They do.
How many people here have ever flown not straight in order to get a few more frequent flyer miles? So we love points, right? We collect points. We walk to collect points. But I think the other thing is that there are some things that we do that we just don't pay attention. For me, the biggest surprise with Fitbit was how little I move on days when I travel. Like, airports always look to me like you're walking forever. Turns out not the case. When you measure it, you actually walk very little. So there's some things we can actually learn. So I'm a fan of this thing, and I think rules for dieting. Anything else on dieting?
Okay. Well, speaking of travel, there's also a question that somebody's kind of wondering, that it seems like you live the life of three men at once and get so much done, and they're wondering how you fit it all in, a sense of what your life is like. You do travel quite a lot. You also teach. You're also writing. You're also conducting research.
Yeah, so lots of coffee. So, yeah, I travel a lot. So
plus you're married. You have two kids, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And my wife keeps on wondering, when am I home? So it's actually, that's a very difficult thing. So, you know, when my first book came out in 2008, it was very exciting. All of a sudden, people wanted for me to spend time with them, and people were excited with the research and so on. And I felt for a short time it was kind of a good time for behavioral economics, and there's lots of good things to do. But the last 6 years, it's only gotten more interesting and more intense. So in the last week I was in Kenya. We have a project in which we're trying to get very poor people to save a little bit of money. We're not talking about retirement. We're talking for a rainy day. So if you're very poor and you lived hand to mouth, and just for 1 month your cow is sick or your goat, and now you don't have income, and you borrow at, let's say, 15% interest a week, and then at the end of the month your goat recovers and you're fully back to where you were, but you're not. You're now almost 2 months behind, and there's almost no way to catch up. So the importance of saving a little bit of money for a rainy day is crucial. By the way, also in the U.S., there's about 40% of Americans that if they had to get tomorrow $2,000, couldn't get it. So it's not just in bad places. So I spent some time, we're doing a project with the pension plan and the government and the cellular company to do the payments. I spent a week. It's very tough to be in those in the slums in Kenya and not to feel that this is something I should spend time on. And then yesterday I was in Seattle with the Gates Foundation. We have some projects on nutrition, and we're trying to get a higher. There's lots of wonderful people who design very, very nutritious food for very poor family. The problem is that it's really hard to convince mothers to feed it to their kids. So the food is there. It's the human are the barrier. By the way, in many, many of our problems, humans are the eventual barrier. It's often not technology. And you can actually think about it on your own lives, right? Just as a thought. How many people here in the last week have eaten more than you think you should? How many people here in the last month have exercised less than you think you should? How many people here have ever texted while driving? If you think about all of those problems, right, these are problems that we are causing ourselves. And this is a place where it's not just technology. It's technology that understands human behavior, understands the places we can fail. And since my days in hospital, I was always motivated by looking at things that people don't do well and trying to think about how we fix that. And I'm just exposed to many more things that are going wrong, and I just get motivated by trying to fix things. So it's life is very interesting, but also very busy. I am taking a week off.
Ooh!
So Monday I'm going to Burning Man, if anybody is.
That's how we got you out here.
Yes.
All right, good. I think I know who this one's from. This is my friend Sarah Holt, because her son is in one of your classes. Mm-hmm. Am I right, Sarah? Is this you? Yes. As someone with one of the most popular courses, online courses, what do you think will be the impact of MOOCs on higher ed?
Yeah, so how many of you have taken a MOOC? Oh, great. So online courses have been with us for a long time. The Open University have sent people video cassettes for many, many years. The revolution of MOOCs is the massive online course is the coordination. We're saying we're not just putting videos out. We're putting videos out in a timed way. And we ask all the students to take it at the same time. And the benefit of that is that the students can help each other. So I taught a class on Coursera, which is one of the platforms that does this. And it was a really interesting experience. So first of all, it was a tremendous investment. We spent about 3,000 hours videoing and editing. Videoing less, editing more. Editing is a lot of work. and creating the best material we could. I'm sure we could do better, but, you know, it was a tremendous amount of work. And then we had this class, and we had about 140,000 people. We had people from 192 countries. It was really very exciting. We felt it was like a very special community, and people created multimedia projects, and people created songs, and we got all kinds of gifts. Came to my lab, people bought us ice cream, and we got food from all over. sent us food from all over the world, and it was a very, very special. It was a very special thing. It was also a ton of work, and I'm not just talking about the 3,000 hours up front. I'm talking about the time of teaching. So if you think about it, and you created a course for lots of people, I know many of you said you took Coursera classes or online classes, but you're basically sampling from the less than normal population. Think about it. You're taking the people who have time, are most likely home. So you're sampling disproportionately for people who have extra time to do all kinds of things. So, for example, in the first day of the class, somebody in this 140,000 student class decided we were doing an experiment on the students, which we were not. So he wrote a letter to the Human Subject Committee of Duke University and told them that he thinks we're doing an experiment on them. And Duke University, under a mandate from the federal government, has to do an investigation into this. So a day in some of my life just goes away. Other stories, nice stories. There was an 11-year-old girl that was taking the class, and her mother called her for dinner, and she insisted, and the girl was in the middle, and her mother turned the computer off, and this was in the middle of the exam. And this mother she's motivated. She finds my phone number, she leaves me messages, she lives in another country, eventually we get to talk to each other. How can I not open the exam for her daughter? I mean, think about it. If you teach a big class, and only 1% of the people have some problem, it's a lot of people. So I think that MOOCs are wonderful. They're a great help on top of video classes. But I think we haven't figured out the right the human model behind it, because I don't think they're going to be self-sustained. I think you can probably do a class where people just help each other, but they're not going to be good classes. And you'll have to figure out a way to deal with the outliers and the people that can't solve problems and so on. And what will be the model for that, I'm not sure. Somebody will have to pay at some point. The fact that I spend a ton of time creating this class and giving it for free, it's very nice, but, and I can do it a few times, it's not sustainable for many years, so we have to figure out a model of how to do this.
Okay. So somebody wants to know who's influenced you, that you've influenced a lot of other researchers and certainly a lot of people, but who have been the greatest influences in your life?
So from a research perspective, so I'll tell you how I got into psychology. When I was still in hospital, I wanted to start studying at the university. From time to time, I could go for a few hours, and I couldn't use my hands. So I registered to study physics. I thought, you know, physics, you don't need to write anything. while that was true in high school, turns out in college you can't do physics without writing. So for a while, somebody would write for me, and I would just read to them equation and say, erase this, but it didn't work out. So I asked my mother to register me for philosophy. I said, here's another thing nobody needs to write anything. And she went to register me for philosophy, and it turns out in Tel Aviv University that you couldn't do only philosophy. You had to pick a double major. It was the last hour of the last day, no cell phones. She registered me for psychology. She comes home, and I am just beside myself. Psychology, the only thing I knew about psychology was the Freudian psychology, and there was this woman in the burn department that would want me to talk about my childhood and mother and all kinds of things all the time. But then the first semester of psychology, I took a class from Hanan Frank. And Hanan was, he lost both of his legs in an explosion of a tank when he was in the military. And he started studying pain as a consequence of that. And first of all, we had a lot of things to share about pain. And I remember a time I went to his office and I told him I just went for the dentist, and I told the dentist not to give me any injections of Novocaine, just to drill, just to do it. And I said, you know, I could feel the pain, I just didn't care so much. And he said he had the same thing. He said in the many years he had since his injury, he didn't take any injections at the dentist. And we started thinking about our own pain experience, and we created the first experiment that I ever participated in. We went to a country club for army people who were injured in the army, and we measured the pain tolerance. We asked people to put their hand in very hot water and see how long they could keep it there. We said, put your hand in hot water, tell us when it becomes from hot to pain, that's the pain threshold, and then keep it there as long as you can. And when you can't, take it out, and we'll measure that as well. And what we found was that the people who had substantial injuries like us could tolerate much more pain. And the way we reasoned about it is that people like us, for us, we had to endure lots of pain for improving health, right? Every time we had a treatment, it was for improving health and so on. We also found that people who had chronic injuries, there were a few people in the sample that had chronic injuries, and they had pain that was connected more to dying sooner, and they had the opposite pattern. But so he was interesting for me because he showed me how you take your personal interest and make it into your profession. But the other thing that he told us is every time we had an idea, he said, and how would you test that? So when I studied philosophy, every time you said, oh, I think this is wrong, or I think something else, they said, well, but have you read Kant in German? Right? Until you do that, you can't talk to me about anything. Hanan had a different approach. Every time he would say, how would you test this? And at some point in his class, I proposed a different theory for how epilepsy works. And he liked the theory. And he said, how would you test it? And I came up with a really complex procedure. How you could implant catheters in the spinal cord of rats and give them epileptic seizure in part and prevent it in another one. He loved the idea, and we started doing experiments, and we gave lots of rat seizure. and the theory was wrong. But that didn't matter so much. I really loved the idea that there's a way to ask questions, and there's an experimental method to try and figure out answer. And I think that's what I've been hooked on, is kind of this idea that we all have questions. We have questions all the time, and here's a method. And you just need to spend a bit of time, and you can get your own answer. And I think it's still very exciting.
Have you met with or worked with Daniel Kahneman at all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Danny was here, and we are. I started working with him when I was still an undergrad. He came to Tel Aviv University at some point, and I helped him on an experiment he was doing with something else, and we've been in touch for many, many years.
Okay. All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time right now, and our thanks to Dr. Dan Ariely, professor of behavioral economics at Duke University and author of the book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. I want to thank our audience here and also our radio, television, and internet audience, and reminding everyone that Dan's book is on sale in the lobby, and he's graciously agreed to sign them. If you could let Dan get out before you start leaving so that he can be ready to sign, we'd appreciate it. I'm Dr. Kit Yarrow, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you, Dan.